Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to do anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then. Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Chan out to the right hand side to Gomez on the edge of the area, left foot across it towards Firmino. Oh! And Firmino, Liverpool have the lead. Roberto Firmino scores again against Arsenal. The cross from the right off his left foot from young Joe Gomez. A wonderful delivery, and Firmino got in between the centre half, heads it down past Petr Cech. 16 minutes gone at Anfield, and Liverpool lead Arsenal by a goal to nil. To the edge of the area, has Salah inside, has Firmino, still has it himself. Oh! Sadio Mane makes it 2-0 to Liverpool. Mo Salah bearing down and goal. 40 yards, 30 yards, there's nowhere near him. A certain turn, it is a turn. Mo Salah, devastating counter-attack from Liverpool in front of the cop. Mo Salah adds to Mane and Firmino. Liverpool's front three all on target, and Liverpool are crushing Arsenal now. Salah plays the ball to the back post. Free header for Daniel Sturridge with his first touch of the game since coming on as a substitute. Heads it home in front of the cop to make it Liverpool 4, Arsenal 0.
Yeah, it was a demolition back in August when Liverpool beat Arsenal by 4-0. I've just realised listening to that I am officially a middle-aged man. I refer to Joe Gomez as young Joe Gomez.
Did you? Well, he's young. He's stating a fact, aren't you?
Yeah,
you're not an old man 20, yourself yet.
20.
Nathan.
Only 20.
I would say as well that you did actually go slightly Italian on your pronunciation of Sadio Mane. Sadio Mane! That's what it came out like, yeah.
Just like to throw myself into the commentary.
Yeah, it was good. I'm not denying it.
It was a great goal.
It was great commentary.
Thanks, Kevin.
It was
thanks,
great commentary,
Kevin.
And that's not being sarcastic.
A lot for Ian Beach and Gary Breen to live up to match myself and Stephen Reid tomorrow night. It is live here on Off the Ball. Arsenal against Liverpool from the Emirates. 7:45 kickoff. We'll have full live and exclusive commentary. And Gary Breen is on the line now. Evening, Gary.
Hi, you guys. How you doing?
Very well. I'd say you're looking forward to this game. It is generally, traditionally, one of the games of the season. Maybe tactically, maybe defensively, you could find a few criticisms, but for pure entertainment, it generally delivers.
No, absolutely. I've really been looking forward to it. When you guys gave me the nod for this game, I couldn't wait for it. And Friday night, under the lights at the Emirates, over the Christmas period, and two teams who are just going to know nothing other than an attack, it's going to be a brilliant game, no doubt.
I think you've got the perfect co-commentator in the game to pick apart the defences on both sides. I think that's what I can imagine you'll be picking it apart tomorrow night, Gary.
Well, no, listen, Liverpool, everyone talks about Liverpool, but they've been quite good defensively since they're drubbing at Tottenham. The fact they haven't conceded a goal in open play in seven games, Kev. So there are improvements there, but in terms of Arsenal, they're just, well, listen, I better save it till tomorrow because I know there'll be Arsenal fans listening in, but defensively, I just can't get my breath with them at times.
I went to the game midweek, Gary. I was at the Emirates for the West Ham match, and I know there's a lot of changes made. The one that maybe not I wasn't really too aware of was the position at left-back with Kolasinac, who'd been left out the side. He actually played midweek, but he's not been in for the last few games. And Arsenal now have gone back to a back four after playing so long now with the back three. How do you think that changes Arsenal? I'm looking at the Kolasinac thing because Maitland-Niles has gone in there at left back as well with all his inexperience, and given what they've paid for Kolasinac to drop him like that, he's got maybe a history of doing this thing. But what do you think with them going back to a back four?
Well, it just sums up the lack of consistency throughout that club on the pitch, at boardroom level, in terms of what they're trying to achieve in terms of going forward. It's incredible. Maitland-Niles is a good young player. He's done really well in the Europa League. And Arsenal have been able to bed a lot of youngsters throughout that campaign that they wouldn't have been able to do if they're in the Champions League. And he's obviously took advantage of that. But you're right, Kolasinac is a massive Arsenal supporters' favourite. So that was a bold decision. But when they went to that back three last season, Kev, I didn't understand it. I couldn't understand that they didn't have two good centre-halves, let alone three. So why you would compound it and go to that system? But it served them well. But I was never overly convinced about it. I didn't think that Monreal as a left-sided centre-half is good enough at an elite-level club like Arsenal. That's been proved. I don't actually think that Mustafi for £35 million, although he's a German international, is good enough to play for Arsenal centre-half either. So the pressure's always on Koscielny, and I think he struggled with the fact he hasn't had a consistent partner. You'll know yourself, centre-half's about getting an understanding with your teammate alongside you, and that's where they've struggled. And everyone talks about the Liverpool problems. I think Arsenal got far, far more problems in terms of the future.
Three at the back was quite fashionable last season, understandably, with Chelsea winning the title and using it so successfully. And one of the big advantages is the width you can use with the two wing-backs. But you look at Kolasinac and Bellerin this season and what they should be offering you in an attacking sense, never mind the defensive side, but in an attacking sense, and you compare it even to Alonso and Moses last season, they never seem to fully understand how to get the best out of those two players.
Well, Bellerin, for example, his career has stalled at Arsenal, and a lot of Arsenal fans will use that as a stick to beat Arsene Wenger in terms of players, young players who haven't gone on to achieve what they should have done. They'll talk about Oxlade-Chamberlain, who will be obviously a massive topic of conversation tomorrow coming back to Arsenal, but many other young players. But you're right. The problem is, and if you're comparing them to Chelsea, you can't really, because the bottom line is that their back five will be coached every hour that is possible on that training field in terms of where you're supposed to be with the ball and, more importantly, how you adjust without it. And Arsenal just don't do that. They play off the cuff and they've got some fantastic, gifted players. Kevin will tell you that in terms of on any given day, they can win and take a game away from you. But they never, ever will have the consistency needed to challenge and to win a Premier League title.
You mentioned Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain there, Gary. The comments that was made from Jurgen Klopp this week, the way I read it, it was a swipe at Arsene Wenger and how he's developed him. You mentioned there he stalled, Bellerin stalled there at Arsenal. But that seems to be the case with a lot of the players over there. And we spoke, I think we were speaking earlier on about the five players that they had on that. Was it six players in that picture, that famous picture that they had a few years ago? Walcott, all the lads. And none of those players have really kicked on. They've never, none of them have gone to that next level. What do you think that Wenger will be thinking with the criticism, first of all, or if he would see it as criticism from Klopp this week?
I think he's been quite open, Klopp, in terms of how he's talking and trying to talk up Oxlade-Chamberlain. And in doing so, I think there is an angle there that suggests that Arsenal didn't get the best out of him. He said things like, it's unbelievable that he hasn't had more goals to his games, bearing in mind the attributes he has. Oxlade-Chamberlain scored 9 Premier League goals for Arsenal. And you're talking about an attacking midfield. It's an incredible stat. And Klopp has then tried to protect himself by saying, well, listen, they've concentrated more on Ozil and Sanchez to get the goals. And that's probably why Oxlade-Chamberlain didn't get those opportunities to get forward. But even the intensity is completely different for Oxlade-Chamberlain, the way he's playing. He's hitting the type of sprints in games that he never did ever under Arsenal. He's hitting the 80 sprints a game, I think he got in a recent game against Chelsea. I think he was nearly there against Bournemouth as well. And even when I watched Oxlade-Chamberlain when he first went to Liverpool, and he played in that 5-0 drubbing at Manchester City. I think it was about the fifth goal that Sane got. He got it on the inside. He set the ball outside. He bent it into the top corner on the edge of the box. And Oxlade-Chamberlain was playing centre midfield in that game. And I know they were down a man or whatever, but that was irrelevant. He still didn't sense the danger to come over quick enough to stop him, to block him, and then throw his body at it. And that was all because of the education that he had at Arsenal. So I think he will improve at Liverpool. He'll certainly add more intensity to the game. I think that's a requirement playing underneath Klopp, but I would agree there are so many young players who haven't fulfilled their potential in this second decade that Wenger's been out there, because you can't ignore the fact that he developed the likes of Vieira, Henry, Fabregas, Van Persie, all these young players, but he's just not doing it no more. And that's probably the reason why there's been a massive cull behind the scenes in terms of the staff coming in, the likes of Steve Rowley leaving, Mislintat coming in from the Bundesliga at Dortmund, and Cellini or something like that from Barcelona. So you can understand that they're going to try and recruit players that Wenger hasn't done in the last 10 years.
Do you see, on Kevin's point though, in terms of developing players, any signs that Wenger or the entire backroom team are getting better at it? Like, I'm thinking of somebody like Alex Iwobi, and I remember doing a game last season with Kenny Cunningham, and Kenny had very high hopes for him, thinking, actually, you know, he's the type of guy, if you develop him right, you can base your team around. You can really build your team around over the next 4 or 5 years. And already you're starting to look at Iwobi, and he's in the team 1 week. He's out for 3 weeks. He gets a run for 2 or 3 games. Might score one goal in every 5 or 6. He seems to have that same problem of inconsistency that previous generation had as well. How do you go about fixing that?
Well, Iwobi, when he came in, and you're right, Nate, to say that, when he came in at the time, it was a breath of fresh air, because Arsenal were really struggling in terms of that period of time. And suddenly he came in. I remember him playing really well away at Everton, and it gave everyone a boost. Of course it does. It's a local lad coming through the ranks. But you're right. These will be questions that are asked of Wenger in terms of, are you improving players? Because people will look at what Guardiola is doing with those young players at Manchester City and to a lesser extent, the older players and how he has improved all of them, the likes of Otamendi, these type of guys who were struggling, you know, Delph at left back, Raheem Sterling, incredible difference in terms of how he's playing, even David Silva, even Kevin De Bruyne. I know these are elite level players, but he's made them better. That's the difference. And I think this is certainly something that people who are critical of Arsene Wenger will look at and say, all these young stars that are coming through or were coming through Arsenal just are not hitting the heights you expect of them. The likes of Jack Wilshere, I think his injury problems are the reason he hasn't. And that's why it's been of such a disappointment that he struggled to become the player he has. I think if he starts tomorrow night, it'll be his first time he started three games for nearly 3 years in a short space of time. So that's the difficulties there. But no, I look at it as an Arsenal fan growing up, and how Wenger used to develop these brilliant young players from nowhere. We'd never heard of them, the likes of Anelka, and he developed them into superstars. He just doesn't do that anymore.
You don't seem to hear a huge amount of complaints from the players that aren't in the starting 11 for Arsenal. It certainly strikes me that there has been a sort of change in attitude with Wenger over the last year, particularly this season, where he used to be quite good at rotation and changed the team quite a bit and players came in and out. Whereas it seems now he has his preferred 12 or 13, and no matter what Giroud, Elneny, Coquelin, Walcott do, they're not going to force their way in to the starting team. And we're talking about very experienced international players, players who, well, certainly in the case of Elneny, Giroud and Walcott, would be in their international squads for the World Cup. Like, does that cause an issue within the dressing room when you have players of that experience who are training all week, who feel they have the talent to be playing, and it seems no matter what they do, they're not going to get a run?
I think Kev will tell you there's always players who think they should be in the team. I think you can ask anyone, they'll all argue they are. And the less they're in the team, the more in the stands, the better they seem to get in their own mind, certainly. But the guys you just named there and who are ultimately the Europa League team and or the League Cup team, they're not actually good enough to get in this Arsenal team. Then who are you going to replace? If you're going to put Giroud in there, you're not going to play Lacazette. You're not going to play Sanchez. You know, this is the problem you have. Walcott, effectively, with Arsenal going to a back five, made his role in the team redundant, because he's an out-and-out winger. He can't play infield, and he's never going to play wing-back. So that was a problem for him. Elneny, listen, I like Elneny. I think he's a really good player, but he's not Arsenal quality. He's not Arsenal quality if you're looking to win a league, which Arsenal should be looking to do. And the other guys you named aren't also. And as much as they will put a shift in and they're good, honest lads as such, they're not at the required level.
It sounds to me, though, from what you're saying, though, is all that tomorrow night you kind of worry with Liverpool going there, with their attributes, with the pace that they've got in that side, that it could be a bit of a humbling night for Arsenal tomorrow.
I think it's going to be a great night in terms of attacking play. It'll be a great advert. Listen, you've got to listen into it. It's going to be literally end to end.
I'll be listening to you, Gary. Don't worry. We're going to be listening to you. Yeah.
Great promo.
It will listen. This is the type of games that you do look forward to. These are the obviously in terms of how both teams set their stalls out, they literally attack is the best form of defence for them. But I do worry for Arsenal. But at the same time, Kevin, you know this, they've got players who on their day, they can take it away from you. They've done a brilliant performance against Chelsea away. It was a really resolute, really well-disciplined performance. And then suddenly Arsenal supporters and the media start thinking, right, they've cracked it. They've got top players. If they only organised and worked harder, they could challenge. But they don't. They revert to the type. And then suddenly, in going into the North London derby, everyone's thinking, oh, Tottenham are going to maul them. And they don't. They put on their performance of the season.
Yeah.
But then again, they let you down. And this is what Arsenal do as a support. They break your heart because they promise so much but deliver so little in the end. And I look at the situation. Listen, Liverpool just pump Arsenal every time they play them. You know, they just score so many goals. And you think of this Fab Four, this new title for this attacking threat that Liverpool have got. And if I was picking any defence to cope with them, it certainly wouldn't be Arsenal.
Well, this game last season, it was the opening day of the season. And when Liverpool went 4-1 up, now they made a mistake at the back 90 seconds later, which led Arsenal back into it and finished 4-3. But the atmosphere around the Emirates, I always remember, was the most venomous atmosphere I've ever seen towards a manager. The crowd turned, and that could have ended up being 6-7-1 that day. It could easily have been 6-7 at Anfield at the start of this season. How do Arsenal then, having seen the front four for Liverpool, and assuming, and maybe we wouldn't be right to assume that Klopp goes with the four of them tomorrow, considering the rotation he's going through, but if the four were to start, how do Arsenal set up to try to contain them?
Well, listen, the normal thought process is that you would defend deep, you'd protect the penalty box, not allow any space for the pace of Salah, the pace of Mane, those type of guys, and then you'd block that midfield area, 10 area around the edge of your box to stop Coutinho getting on it and shooting from distance. We know how good he is, but that's a total contradiction of what Arsenal were about.
Yeah.
Their old mindset will be, no, listen, we're good enough to take them on. The reality is they're not in an open game of football. But if they can get the ball to the likes of Sanchez, Ozil, and Ozil is playing fantastically well. And a lot of cynical people were saying, well, listen, there's no surprise there. His contract's running down. He's probably caught in admirers elsewhere. But be that may, he's a quality top player. And if he plays well tomorrow, then he'll hurt Liverpool. There's no doubt about it. But I just can't see anything. I'll go there with an open mind. Of course I will. I won't let my frustrations with Arsenal come across too early on in the commentary, I hope. But listen, it's going to be a brilliant game. There's no, and the atmosphere will be fantastic. It's the holiday season here as such. Everyone will be looking forward to this game. Liverpool will travel in big numbers. The atmosphere will be, you'll hear it through. There's no doubt about it. But in terms of stopping that front four, Arsenal just haven't got the ability to do it. And sometimes you might look for a bit of energy in that midfield area to stop the supply line to them. But Granit Xhaka just is not mobile enough to do that. Ramsey's ill-disciplined in terms of he'll run out of our position. There'll be no blocking passing channels. There'll be no organised setting traps so they can counter. Because the reality is, with Arsenal's counter-attacking pace that they've got, they should play that way. They should defend deep and look to counter. Because when they do it, they're brilliant. But they won't do that tomorrow.
Just on, you mentioned Ramsey, so he's going to miss the game through injury. And it seems as though the change to four at the back has coincided with Ramsey dropping out of the team because of the injury. And they've gone with Ozil and with Wilshere in there. Is that just, and Iwobi coming in as well, but is that he can't trust Wilshere to come in and do the job, that Wilshere just simply doesn't have the legs to be a like-for-like replacement for Ramsey? Like, changing to four at the back, it should make them stronger, surely, further up the pitch.
Well, listen, Wilshere will come in, and he has got better with every game he's played. I've watched a lot of his games in the Europa League, and with each game, he's looked like he's had that burst of energy. Kev, do you remember when he used to pick the ball up and he'd just run away from people? And the injuries looked like they could tell that, but he's slowly but surely getting that back. But the problem is that when you think of how good he was and the fact that I think he played something like 30 times under Hodgson for England. So they built that England team around him. Forget how it all went so bad for him at the Euros. But they put so much stock in him playing as the midfield playmaker, the number four role deep. Wenger never plays him there. He doesn't trust him there. He plays him at 10. And if you think about playing at 10, it's blocked already in terms of Ozil wants to play there. Ramsey wants to play there. So he's never going to get that role. Whether or not that contract situation for Wilshere changes, I think a lot depends on whether or not they sign Ozil. I think if they sign Ozil, then I don't expect to see Wilshere stay at Arsenal.
On Liverpool then, you mentioned statistically, you can come up with lots of statistics to show that Liverpool are a very good defensive side, that they're a team who don't concede many goals. One goal conceded from open play in their last seven league games. But then you look at the flaws, the moments of absolute madness, and if they hadn't had them, where they might be in the league this season. Like, is that just that Dejan Lovren? So take the Everton example, where Liverpool are so comfortable. Like, they should be really 2 or 3 nil up at that stage. They've had little or nothing to do. Is that what separates a good defender and a great defender? Having that concentration that when the one time comes, 78 minutes into the game, and you have to do some defending, that you do your job correctly?
No, listen, concentration levels are massive, but I wouldn't, as much as he might concentrate, I don't think he's a top defender anyway. I think he's a good defender, but I don't think he's a top one. I was very surprised Liverpool has a massive financial outlay. It probably doesn't seem a lot now in terms of the way the transfer market has gone, but at the time it was a huge one. But you're right, because Liverpool should have won that game. Mane's got to square that for 2-0. It's over. But even more than just the push, Nathan, was his body shape for the diagonal ball over his top, over his right shoulder. His body shape was all wrong initially. And you're thinking, why are you not sensing that danger? That's really the only place that ball could have been played.
Like, is that a basic?
Because it's a basic in terms of just adjusting your body, dropping your hips so that when the ball's on his left-hand side, he's just in the right body shape so that he can attack it on the front foot, but he can recover because he's on the half turn for any ball in behind. He doesn't. The ball goes over his shoulder and it looks like internally, he nearly falls over. And then with that comes panic. Mm. Rather than having that confidence just to say, I'm in control of this situation, he panics and he tries to overcompensate. And I think that's what happens a lot with Lovren, because he's competitive. He's a strong type defender. He likes physical contact as such. And that's what happens. But you look at Arsenal's situation defensively, I think there's a massive rebuilding there. But I look at Liverpool's and I think, listen, if they can just get that one centre-half in the building, a quality one who can cope in terms of being pulled out into wide areas and full-back areas, the likes of Alderweireld, Vertonghen, how so good they are at Tottenham. If they can get someone like that, they get Nathaniel Clyne back in at right-back if he gets back from his injuries. They've got Joe Gomez, who excelled for England at centre-half against Germany and Brazil. So they have got them. They have got the... They are on... They really are so close to having a really top team. But for me, it would always be the Achilles heel. I don't think their goalkeeper, as good as he is, as a good of hard-working keeper, I don't think he's elite level. And I don't think that Lovren's elite level as well. This is Liverpool we're talking about here.
Who do you like then? So they're going to go for Van Dijk, presumably again during January, whether they go to 70 million, whether
City,
that's accepted.
City are in as well, aren't
they?
They might get bullied out of it by City now. Because if you're Van Dijk, I mean, in terms of meeting Klopp, I can imagine the charismatic nature comes out and you want to go for it. And he probably in the summer looked at the situation and thought, well, look at the players they've got. Coutinho's there. It'd be brilliant. But now, if you're a player, and Kev, back me up on this. If you're a player now, you've got a decision to make. Where are you going to go? Liverpool, yeah. Man City.
Do you know what, Gary? I think we're led to believe, and I believe it to be true, that Klopp has turned his head massively. Klopp has really sold the Liverpool dream to him, to Van Dijk. He was going to choose Liverpool over City, and Chelsea were both in for him at the time. And I think he sees a real legacy there in going to Liverpool, something that even long after he's finished, he sees himself as being this player that will always be associated with that club. I think that was the thing that Jurgen Klopp has actually sold to him. So I think, given the choice, yeah, I know what you're saying. It's potentially he's going to win a Premier League if he goes to City, but is he going to change his mind that dramatically in the space of a few months? If Liverpool do come back in, I believe he's probably going to go there.
Well, do you know what, Kev? I really like to hear that there's a bit of, you know what I mean, a bit of pride, a bit of honesty, that if he's given his word, he's going to keep it. Brilliant. And if that happens, and I remember at the time I said this to you, Nathan, when it was initially announced and it looked like he was going there in the summer, I thought, wow, what a signing. Because I'll tell you why. This is a centre-half, and I've said this to you a couple of times before, this is one who can deal with your Andy Carrolls of this world because he's got that type of physicality, so dominant. I was working for you guys. I've seen him playing against West Ham. He bullied Andy Carroll. I don't think there's any centre-half who can do that. So he's got that. He can step into midfield and make a pass. We've seen he's the type of centre-half who actually takes strikes on goal. He's that technically gifted. But the main thing for me, certainly going to Liverpool, is that he's the type of centre-half that if he gets dragged out wide into those full-back areas, which invariably you will do in terms of playing for Liverpool because of that high press, the first top six go after the opposition, they might just miss him out with long balls down the channels. He can cope so easily in there because I've seen him play against Liverpool last season. And he'd brush Mane aside for pace. So he has got every attribute. And if people are saying to me, well, there must be something he's lacking, the only thing he is actually lacking is his concentration levels, because at times the game is just too easy for him. So he needs someone who rides in, maybe a really dominant goalkeeper, a really dominant centre midfielder, who says to him, listen, concentrate. Listen, we're most vulnerable when we look like we're most comfortable. And even if you research any of his work that he'd done in Holland with his coaches there, they would back all that type of theory up, is that the game at times is so easy, and in that moment, he just lets himself down with his concentrations.
You cover a lot of games for us at the weekends. If they don't get Van Dijk, who are the other centre-backs you've seen within the Premier League this season that you've been really impressed with, that have those attributes that Liverpool need?
Well, if I could pick any two centre-halves to play for Liverpool under Klopp's system, it would be Vertonghen and Alderweireld in terms of if it wasn't Van Dijk. And my point being that the modern-day centre-half now is not about dealing with two centre-forwards and having that robust nature. It's how good you are dealing with people attacking from wide into those central areas. So down your shoulders, when you get dragged out into those full-back positions, can you cope? It's about mobility now more than physical presence. That's why he's so special, Van Dijk, is that he's got both. But everyone was talking about, well, why didn't Klopp, if he couldn't get Van Dijk at that time, why didn't he go and get Davinson Sanchez like Tottenham did? He made the perfect decision not to get him, because Davinson Sanchez is not right for Liverpool. He's okay slotting in between Vertonghen and Alderweireld because they'll coach him through it, and he's good in a three. You play him in a two. I see a lot of him at Ajax last year. He gets vulnerable. He makes rash decisions. His line of engagement is always square on. So any ball touched past him, he invariably fouls, gives away a lot of free kicks. So he's not the right one, but I looked at it at the time and Klopp and thought, brilliant. I'm so delighted that you haven't took your plan B and you're so adamant you're going to get plan A. And if Kev, if you led me to believe that it's done, then I think it's been a very brave decision, but a very good one, because he's took a lot of flack in terms of sticking with his centre-halves at Liverpool. But if he knew that Van Dijk was coming in the building, why block your centre-half options by bringing in someone that you don't think is your first choice?
Great stuff as always, Gary. Have you got a prediction for tomorrow night?
Goals.
That's going in the promo straight away. Brilliant stuff, Gary. You're going to be with Ian Beach at the Emirates tomorrow. It's a 7:45 kickoff. It is live and exclusive here on Off the Ball. If we don't talk to you before the Christmas, Gary, have a good one.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Gary Breen there, as I say, on commentary for Arsenal against Liverpool. He's good. He knows the centre backs.
Yeah, he's good. He's very he's great on body shape of centre half. Something that it's difficult really to try and get across at times. And
would he have been at you when you were in Ireland training about your body shape?
Yeah, definitely. He was a very good talker. You know, he played alongside Kenny for a lot of his games. Two brilliant talkers on the pitch. You know,
there's a headache.
Yeah, no, but they were good. They were good, particularly if I was ever playing in front of them as a midfielder as well. Body shape, get your body shape right, check your shoulders, all these little sort of things. But particularly when he's talking about centre halves, and he's spot on with the Lovren thing. Lovren, he gets caught out. Rooney's pass was very good for that goal, yes, but he gets his body shape wrong. And as soon as centre forwards or as soon as attacking players can see the defender's number, your body shape's all wrong.
It's not something you really think a huge amount when you think of coaching is body shape.
Yeah.
You think about ball work and a lot of that. But the Pep Guardiola clip with Raheem Sterling was all about his body shape being set up, the defender think he was going to go one way, that he'd be able to have the ball gone and pretty much sprinting away within the same step. Was that something you did spend a lot of time on? Is that something defensive coaches would spend a lot of time
with defenders? Again, I didn't grow up a defender, so it's a bit different. I think defenders individually would have had that sort of work individually as a back four, individually on a personal basis. But I think certainly when I was then moved back to left back, I think that's the one thing that you'd probably struggle with, or I would have struggled with as well, was as a defender, was certainly because you're playing left back, it's your left shoulder then attacking players over your left shoulder when you're facing in field. Check your shoulders, get your shoulder open, do not let defenders see your number, keep your body shape up, and do not allow the defender to get a good run at you. All these sort of little things. But if that ball is switched over your head, you're in a position then to be moving with the ball. So if the lad gets a touch, you can go and tackle him, you can go and take him straight away. Or if he does take the touch and the ball's with him, then you can actually drop, but your body shape's in a position that you're not actually just following the ball and you get caught out easily. Little things like this are very good, but Gary was always very good on that, yeah.
All right, very good. As I say, live tomorrow night, Arsenal against Liverpool. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to be talking about the other big game of the weekend, the Clásico, with Graeme Hunter.
Off the Ball.
In association with Air. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the Air Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
It is the most wonderful time of the year. Midday, Saturday, Irish time, Real Madrid, Barcelona. Graeme Hunter, good evening.
It's beginning to look a lot like the Clásico.
Well, listen,
if you're going to give it most wonderful, we could do this all night.
Wow. Why is this game kicking off at midday on Saturday? I'm going to assume money.
There's been complaints from all over Ireland and saying we want it at 12 o'clock.
10 o'clock Saturday night is exactly when we would have wanted it.
At least we can get the game on Sky anyways. That's not too bad.
There you go. Marketing says that it's time that Spain woke up, and it's going to be at that time of day. There's an hour difference between the clocks in Spain and the UK and Ireland, but it's the same reason as you get lunchtime Saturday kickoffs. In the Premier League, it's long overdue that Spain woke up. You both know that the premium marketing game in La Liga isn't Alaves against Malaga, and therefore when the Clásico is used as a tool to increasingly earn extra billions rather than millions, it will be moved around. It will eventually, at one stage, I imagine, be played on a Friday. At one stage, it will be played at lunchtime on a Sunday. There are many, many markets around the world where this midday Central Europe kickoff means that people can watch it without getting out of their beds at 3 in the morning. You can't keep everybody happy. But there is no doubt that we're seeing. Listen, it's also true that 10 years ago, when Schuster's Real Madrid came to the Camp Nou and stamped on the fingernails of Frank Rijkaard as he clung on to his career, Julio Baptista and Van Nistelrooy linking up for Baptista to score in a 1-0 win. It was the penultimate Clásico of Rijkaard. It was on the 23rd of December. So it's happened before. It's been a decade since it happened. But Spain is gradually, very gradually, waking up to the need to market itself and to keep up with the money supply in the Premier League, which has definitely begun to impact on every club, with the possible exception of Barcelona and Real Madrid, even though Neymar's buyout clause was met.
Were there any complaints about it being quite so close to Christmas? Because I'd imagine this is a huge revenue earner for both Barcelona and Madrid as cities in terms of the amount of tourists who travel to see this game and the amount of people who think, all right, 2 days before Christmas, maybe not this time.
You can sell a Clásico out, particularly at the Bernabeu, which is a smaller capacity, by some nearly 20,000 for a Clásico pretty simply. I mean, if there were complaints, I understand your logic, and it's good logic. Those complaints might be coming from a tourist in Australia or a tourist in Japan or a tourist in China rather than from the locals.
Yeah, they're happy enough.
There are going to be... You've struck on a point. Once you start disrupting the traditional ways in which stadia are filled, when the Clásico is played, either what stage of the season... is it random? There was a day when Steve Archibald moved from Spurs to Barcelona and played in his first competitive Clásico. It was the first game of the season. Now, it just doesn't matter how random the computer's supposed to be in the draw for La Liga's fixtures. That ain't going to happen anymore, believe me. So if there are complaints, the truth of it is all the clubs who are now getting a slightly bigger slice of the pie want more money. Real Madrid and Barcelona need more money. In order to compete with Paris Saint-Germain, the petrodollar clubs, the extra TV revenue in the UK. There's been very few complaints about this, I'd have to tell you.
So Barcelona start the game 11 points clear of Real, albeit with a game in hand, with Real going off and winning the World Championship. But last weekend, Barcelona beating Deportivo La Coruña 4-0. And if you didn't see the game, I think most people will have seen the wonder goal,
that goal
that was finished off by Suarez. And I wanted to ask you about the main player in the build-up, which was like the little drag back heel from Iniesta.
My favourite player.
On the edge of his own area. And just where Iniesta is right now in his career, at 33, playing an hour a game, has he still got it all? Has he adapted his game?
But we're eulogising him now, in all seriousness. I have to say to you, which Suarez goal? Really, genuinely, because the first one, Iniesta plays this unbelievable...
Dink, yeah.
There won't be a quarterback pass in the Super Bowl in January better than this pass, where the ball breaks out from the Deportivo La Coruña box following a set play into the box. And it's significantly outside the box. Iniesta looks left over his shoulder to see if Alva's overlapping. He's not, because he's still caught up high in the box. He then shouldn't be able to see Messi. This isn't the goal you were meaning. I know that. But Messi's onside because he's in a cluster of players. And he just can't see him. But plays this beautiful quarterback pass, which Messi runs onto, controls in his chest, and lays it past Ruben into the path of Suarez for 1-0. It's an unbelievable goal. It's Iniesta as Xavi. Now, what you're talking about, I think was a thing of absolute beauty. You know, the Sistine Chapel of football. Pardon me my coughing. If you look at his little wriggle and back heel away from three Deportivo La Coruña players, the Iniesta you're talking about, that's what he did. That's his trademark throughout his career. The ball then shuttles about between Paulinho and Messi and Busquets and Alex Vidal and out wide to Roberto. And the cross in, the assist from Roberto is sublime. It's Da Vinci. It's geometric perfection onto the foot of Suarez. What you have to realise about that game is that he came off early because Iniesta consistently, although he's played more games, more minutes this season than in the majority of his recent season under Luis Enrique, who had less and less trust in Iniesta's physical ability. Valverde has made this guy his touchstone. He plays whenever he's available. As soon as they can get him back, they ship him in. As soon as that game was won, they took him off. He looks like, if Barcelona are to seal this league and win, Iniesta will need to play well. Iniesta has reserved some of his great performances for the Bernabeu. Is he, at his age now, able to be playing four, five, six, 90 minutes in a six-week period. No, absolutely not. Does he pull up more regularly with muscle pain or muscle warnings? Yes, he does. When he's on form, can he still do the same things that made him great, that made him cherished, loved all over the world? Yes, he definitely can.
Great. Just in relation to that one as well, I just actually looked through a bit of his stats today. So 2011-2012, he has 10 assists. 2012-13-20, 10 then the following season. Then there's a big drop-off. Looking at him this season, he's not necessarily getting the assists. He still actually doesn't have any assists this season, but he'll always be heavily involved, as Nathan has touched on, that in the beautiful goals that Barcelona do score, he's the one that would normally make that key pass that opens up a defence. He's still having a huge impact, but albeit a little bit deeper in the field.
I knew you were going there, and that's exactly right, Kevin, that Iniesta requires to play deeper, not because physically he can't get up and down. If there was a structure behind him in that Barca team whereby they could keep the ball, move the ball, drag opponents around, open teams up, he would be playing 15 or 20 metres higher up the pitch very regularly. He'd be scoring occasionally and he'd be assisting much more regularly. He is now much more deep-lying because he is the guy who drives the tempo, drives the structure of the play. It's a slightly different role for him, a different responsibility for him, just like captaincy was when he took it over. And to give Barca equilibrium and balance and tempo, he does play an awful lot deeper. And that will remain the case throughout the rest of his career, because around him, the midfield is now functional. It's packed. Quite often, instead of a three-man midfield under Guardiola, what you'll see is a six- or seven-man midfield with four originally in it, Messi dropping back, one or other of the two full-backs popping in to give superiority of numbers, and it includes Iniesta, and that's Barcelona's main strength right now.
Thomas Vermaelen is a player who, sort of been derided since his move to Barcelona. A lot of mocking about his lack of game time, but suddenly with the injury to Umtiti, he's been thrown right in at the deep end, and here he is probably going to start a Clásico on Saturday at centre-back. His story over the last couple of years, I know he went on loan at one stage out to Roma, but is he just the type of character who kept his head down, who's good around the training pitch, who's a good person to have around the squad, happy to wait for his chance?
He's liked and respected, and I think that you've got it about 75% right. When he was in Belgian duty, he spoke very clearly and pungently about my situation is disgraceful. They wouldn't let me leave in the summer. The Spanish rules don't let me play for Barca B. I can't drop down. I'm stuck. I'm in a kind of Bermuda Triangle. It's a sort of Marie Celeste situation for him. He's there, but the rest of his career is deserted. He's got lucky in a way. Not only Umtiti is out, but Mascherano was out, and therefore Vermaelen simply had to play. He's done, I think, almost nothing wrong. You'd give him a 9.5 out of 10 for all the games he's played since the injuries hit the team. But I would ask, ahead of the Clásico, has he been tested? Has he been turned? Has his pace been worked over? Has he played rivals like the movement of Benzema, Isco, Modric, or Carvajal and Marcelo overlapping? I'd have to say no, he hasn't. And while, like you, I think on balance he probably does start, my instinct is that it would be better, it makes more sense, that Mascherano, a warrior at this level, totally experienced, reads the game well, perfect partner for Piqué, and probably if anybody is able to come in after a spell out and not show the rustiness and to be able to use his brain ahead of simply match sharpness, I think it would be Mascherano. But I suspect that what you're going to have called it right, and that because Mascherano is leaving in January, guaranteed to go to Chinese football, Yerry Mina, the Colombian who's playing in Brazil for Palmeiras right now, is coming in. I think Vermaelen is probably going to prove to have earned his shot at this. And if he comes through the Clásico, and blooming heck, if they win to go 14-11 ahead, that will clear Real Madrid out of it. I still think Real Madrid have title possibilities. I think that they can, if they win this Clásico, they can overturn a gap by winning at Leganés, turning it down to a smaller gap than it's 8 net. They've never overturned that in their history, ever. Nobody ever has. But I think Real Madrid can if they win this game. But if Vermaelen is part of a bus on the side that goes and wins this Clásico, Madrid will not win the title. And his legacy for a club that he's barely featured in will be assured.
Yeah, you said to us across the course of this season, really, that Barcelona, even though they're unbeaten, things just aren't quite all rosy at the moment. So do you see then this is that must-win game for Real Madrid? They have to go there. They have to maybe exploit any sort of vulnerabilities.
Sure.
If they don't, then that's league over.
For sure. I think if Madrid draw this, then I'm going to look at it and assemble what I saw and what the players look like and behave like and what Zidane says, and then work out whether a draw leaves them in any kind of shape at all. If with a win, I think that the house of cards can crumble. If Roma did win this, but if they lose, they will not win the title. If the gap is too big. The punch to the jaw as the new year starts will be too big. There are three trophies to the good this season already. They have had horrendous circumstances between suspension and injury and associated lack of sharpness after suspension and injury. And there's been, Toni Kroos said it today, and I admire his honesty. He said, after you win so much, occasionally it's hard to be as motivated as you were at the beginning. That's just honesty. That you shouldn't be castigated for that. That's just brutal. You know it to be true. The listeners know it to be true. Real Madrid have been afflicted by all these things. If you put their best 11 on the pitch, on form and sharp, against Barca's best 11, on form and sharp, Real Madrid win it. That's what I suspect we might see on Saturday. And if they do win it, it's absolute 100% game on. But anybody who's looking at the Champions League and thinking Real Madrid's situation isn't strong enough, the squad isn't strong enough, no James, no Pepe, no Morata, they can't win the Champions League, I would say think again. Very, very difficult club to shake off. You think they're in the mud, and suddenly they're clean as a whistle.
Graham, great stuff. We look forward to it. Enjoy
the
Christmas.
Enjoy the game, lads. Enjoy the game.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Happy Christmas to all your listeners.
Happy Christmas. Great stuff, Graham. We will be, of course, covering the game on Saturday's show from 1 o'clock. Let's take a quick break.
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the AIR Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome back. We're almost done. Where are you this weekend?
I'm at Leicester, Everton and Chelsea. Everton, ooh, Chelsea.
Tasty.
Yeah, good
tasty
game. Early kickoff, 12:30.
Saturday, very good. Anywhere Stephen's Day?
I am doing much today.
Are you going to call it St. Stephen's Day or are you going to call it Boxing Day?
Well, I'll be over there, be on the BBC with Gary Lineker and Danny Murphy, so it'll have to be.
You're one of us. No, you can maybe teach them a lesson.
Stephen's Day.
You would,
yeah,
go down in proper legendary status if you called it these traditional St. Stephen's Day fixtures to Gary Lineker and Danny. Like,
Is this a test?
This is an opportunity for you.
Is this a test?
It's not even a test. This is something you should want to embrace.
Right, okay. All right, then.
I'm just saying. So you're our match of the day. Yeah. Stephen's not... Ooh, that'll be a big viewing figures.
Yeah, I think it's the biggest one of the year, I think.
That'll be about 11, 12 million.
No, not that high. But
no?
No, not, well, maybe not,
oh,
that
sorry,
high.
No, no. What am I saying? About 4 or 5 million.
Maybe
five
a, bit, million? A bit higher, perhaps. Maybe, yeah.
This is... I'm telling you, this is a huge opportunity. And also, if you do it, nobody's going to criticise you. Nobody will criticise you. The English people are perfectly fine with this.
Yeah.
They'll go, what's he talking about?
Are you
That's
sure?
interesting.
Are you
they'll
sure?
Wikipedia. They'll, yeah, Google it. It's fine.
Are you sure?
The Irish people, though, if you say, call it Boxing Day, I would turn your Twitter off for a little while because you're going to be absolutely destroyed.
Well, I tell you something now.
I wouldn't encourage it, of course. It,
I'd get destroyed on Twitter by one and all, I would imagine, if I said that, yeah.
So call it St. Stephen's Day.
All right.
Don't mind the Brexit ears. Those people, you don't,
yeah,
care for them anyway.
No, exactly.
Well,
exactly.
That's very good. I'll tune in. Well, maybe. I'll be out in Ballyhonus, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I'll get them to switch it on. The
You'll
pub.
Be back home. You'll be back home, yeah. Yeah, go to the pub. You might be able to see me. You probably won't hear me at that stage of the night.
Yeah, all right. Tomorrow morning, we'll be up, of course, as always, on a Friday morning, bright and early, 7:45. Our newest team member. We're getting another sporting superstar in. Somebody might be feeling the pressure. Andy Lee has joined Team Off the Ball. And he's going to be in the studio.
Please don't call it Team OTB or Team Off the Ball.
Team OTB.
No.
The OTB
no,
team.
I can't be asked for that crap when they come out with that. You know,
listen,
honestly.
This is what the marketing people suggest.
Team GB and all that. Oh.
We're like Team GB, year by year, one of us being disgraced and shamed.
Yeah, how many times has that happened to me across the course of this year?
Drug tested and things going badly wrong. Let's just get through to Christmas. Andy Lee is going to be in studio with Adrian Barry, off the ball, rapidly turning into the Galacticos of sports radio is what JP has written down in front of me. Andy Lee, Brian O'Driscoll, Tommy Walsh, Eddie O'Sullivan, Keith Andrews, Donico Callan, Brian Kerr, Kenny Cunningham, David Brady, and of course, we've probably forgotten loads there, including Kevin Kilbane and my good self, the quiz champions of the world. Tomorrow morning, the lads will also have Warren Gatland on the show, and it wouldn't be an Adrian Barry show without the Barry-ometer. Myself and Kev will be along as well. You can watch it on Facebook, YouTube, Periscope, across all of Off the Ball social channels from 7:45 a.m. Tomorrow night, Brian O'Driscoll is going to be in studio alongside Jer and Dave, talking about CJ Stander, Peter O'Mahony, Keane Healy's ban, Manu Tuilagi's tackle, Johnny Sexton's concussion problems. Plenty to get into tomorrow night, as well as that at 7:45. Full match commentary from the Emirates, Ian Beach and Gary Breen there for Arsenal against Liverpool. Tom Dunn is up next. Good night.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.